So now that we're done with the Pentateuch, it's time for us in CD number 2 to undertake an overview of the historical books of the Bible and the poetic books of the Bible. We'll be beginning with the book of Joshua, and we'll end with the Song of Solomon. Now, at this point in the Bible, God has His chosen people. They are poised at the borders of their promised land, and the big complainers that left from Egypt are all dead. God's people now have a system of worship that was instituted, and also a system of sacrifice, and they have a perfectly designed mobile place of worship, and a whole tribe, the Levites, devoted to its care and function. So now, when the Hebrews went into the land to conquer it, they were led now by Joshua. Now, as I mentioned before, he had been Moses' assistant, so he was prepared for the job. And one of the greatest events under Joshua's leadership was the drying up of the Jordan River, which allowed the Israelites to cross over and to conquer the land west of the Jordan. Now, another significant event in this book is the Battle of Jericho, which you'll see in chapter 6. And they went on under Joshua's leadership to conquer pretty much all of the rest of the land. Now, they did leave some pockets unconquered, and that was against God's edict. He told them to conquer all of the people, leaving none. And many people would say that their failure to do so completely also has led to some of what we see happening in the Middle East today. Now, this book also features Rahab the harlot, that many of you have probably heard of, who helped God's people prepare for the Battle of Jericho, and she was blessed because of it. As a matter of fact, she became part of the Messianic lineage. And so once the land was conquered, it was also divided. It was now time to give all of the tribes their land. And you've probably heard me mention before that the Levites did not have any specific inherited land that they could call their own. There were certain specific cities where some place was made for them, but largely their place was to minister in the temples. They did not get a separate segment of land to themselves. And so the next book in the Bible is the book of Judges. And this book pertains to the events among the Jewish people after the death of Joshua. And although this is where the book of Judges starts, in a practical sense, Moses and Joshua had been judges also. They were God-sent men that governed all of God's people. And that's essentially what the role of the judges was. Now, Moses, of course, was more known as a prophet. So now at this point, again, there's 2.5 tribes that were given a land east of the Jordan River. These tribes were the tribe of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. And they had left their land, which was east of the Jordan, to go with the other tribes and to help them conquer the land west of the Jordan. And then when they were done, they were allowed to go back to their land. Again, this was Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. The other tribe of Manasseh was, the other half, excuse me, was given land west of the Jordan River. And so all of that land, which was west of the river, was divided up as well amongst the other 9.5 tribes. Now, this is actually 8.5 tribes, because that did not include the Levites, as I mentioned before, because the Bible says that God was their inheritance. And of course, most of the sacrifices that were given became their inheritance, meaning their source of food, etc., as well as something called the showbread, which was inside the temple. Levites could also eat that. So, anyway, the 12 tribes, just to list them for you, are Reuben, Gad, Manasseh, Benjamin, Levi, Judah, Asher, Naphtali, Zebulun, Dan, Simeon, and Ephraim. So these are the 12 tribes Israel. Now, all of the members of these tribes were under the leadership of Joshua during the conquer of the land and right after the conquering of the land. And while under Joshua's leadership, the Hebrews were certainly not perfect, but they did not stray far from God. But after Joshua's death, the Hebrews asked for a king, and they ended up having a kingdom instead of being ruled by the judges. Other peoples had kings, and the Israelites were envious and wanted a king. God pleaded with them not to have a king because he was their king, and he tried to get them to understand that they would not be better off, they'd be worse off with a king than to be led by him via the judges. But the people wanted it their way, and God allowed them to have their permissive will, or his permissive will rather than his perfect will. Now, before they had the kings, the people, after Joshua died, were governed by a series of judges. Now, these certain notable ones would be Deborah, Gideon, and Samson. These were people that were anointed and appointed by God and led God's people to the best of their ability, but certainly did not allow them to stray very far from God. This is very different ultimately under the kings, and that's really the best way to understand what the judges were, is to contrast them with the kings. Because once they had kings to rule over them, the people ruled, the people that ruled were motivated by politics and power. Now, not 100%, but the problem is politics and power was a huge part of it, and then God was often secondary, if at all, under many kings. And of course, the power would follow bloodlines and conquest rather than godly appointment and anointing. So now the next book in the Bible is the book of Ruth. This is a short but very powerful book about a Moabitess woman whose loyalty and faithfulness and compassion was recognized and rewarded by God. You may recall Ruth from my message, Uncovering God's Hidden Treasure. Just to recap briefly, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, of course, were terrible cities where sin was running rampant and homosexuality in a very aggressive way had taken over the city. And Lot, which was Abraham's nephew, was there, and God allowed Abraham to save Lot and his family. And when Lot and his family got out of Sodom and Gomorrah and walked away before its destruction, Lot's wife looked back against God's decree not to look back, and she was turned into a pillar of salt. Once Lot and his two daughters arrived at a safe place, unfortunately Lot became drunken, and his two daughters both had sexual relations with him and became pregnant with children. They claimed that this was a way to forward their father's seed. And the oldest one, the oldest child, was named Moab, and the child is of the oldest daughter was named Moab, and that's where the Moabite people came from. And they were basically born out of sin with these daughters having done. The other one's name was Ammon, which gave rise to the Ammonites. But these people, these young men, were born out of a very sinful situation, and their peoples resulted in very sinful, not God-fearing people, and they were enemies of the Israelites. And so Ruth, being a Moabitess woman, serving other gods, other pagan gods, made this journey of hers very unlikely and very, very noteworthy. So then the next books would be 1 and 2 Samuel. Now, Samuel himself was the last of the judges. Again, as I mentioned before, the people insisted on having a king like others around them. And so God ordained a very unroyal appearing David to be king. But before he took the throne, the very first king was Saul. Now, before David actually became king, he was mostly on the run from Saul himself, who wanted to kill David because he heard about the fact that David had been anointed officially to be king. Now, along the way, David had a very eventful life, including the killing of Goliath, the Philistine giant. Now, once David took the throne, his probably most famous or infamous act was early on with his indiscretion with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, and later actually his deliberate, that is David's deliberate arrangement for Uriah to be killed in battle, Uriah being a very loyal subject to the king. Now afterwards David repented of this sinful act, and from then on he was a better person, and he was indeed a good king. Now if you read those sections of scripture, you will see that David did not go unpunished for his indiscretion and his sin, but he was definitely a better man and a better king after that. Now it was during this time that David wrote most of the Psalms, many psalms of praise unto a worthy God, and also many psalms of crying out to God in times of difficulty, struggle, and calamity. Now when David was an old man near death, he made Solomon king, Solomon his son. David commissioned the building of a permanent temple for God because he felt that it wasn't right that he lived in a great house and God had no house, a permanent house to live in. Now God did not ask for this, but he allowed it. But he did not allow David to build the temple. But David was able to procure the necessary materials for the building of the temple. It would, however, be left up to his son Solomon to accomplish the actual building of the edifice itself. Now Solomon, for his part, had a very good beginnings. Solomon had a choice from God of anything that he wanted to ask for. And Solomon asked that he would receive wisdom to properly govern God's people. Now that's pretty awesome. That definitely tickled God's fancy. And because of this, he not only gave him or made him the wisest man that ever lived up to that time, but also the richest man in the world for his time. And he actually has maintained, and many and maybe most people's eyes that believe in the Bible, as the wisest man that ever lived. Now he indeed successfully built the first permanent temple for the Hebrew God, and it's called the Solomon's Temple or the Temple of Solomon. Of course, it's the Temple of God, but it carries his name because he built it. Of course, we read in Luke that, you know, later on, of course, this temple was destroyed, and it was rebuilt by Herod, as you may recall, Herod the Great. So now Solomon made many mistakes in his life, and he had many wives outside of the Hebrew faith, which was against God's will, and he terribly overtaxed his people among his many other indiscretions in his life. But through all of this, he learned a great number of lessons from his mistakes. And his God-given gift of wisdom was manifested and written down, and you'll find that mostly chronicled in the book of Proverbs. And then if you look in the book of Ecclesiastes, you will see a different angle, a more experienced Solomon speaking of the mistakes essentially that he had made, or what he had learned from his exploits in life. And you see in Ecclesiastes a more seasoned, experienced man attempting to prevent others from reliving his own mistakes. And so Solomon was king of Israel for a total of 40 years. Now, forgive me, I forgot to mention that everything that we've been talking about from David's death and on into Solomon, etc., that's all found in the book of 1 Kings. I'm very sorry, I forgot to mention to you that we'd gone over from the books of Samuel, excuse me, over into Kings. So now, after Solomon's death, and if you take a look at 1 Kings, you'll see all about Solomon's exploits and his wisdom and all the great things he did, and built the temple and dedicated it, and was visited because of his wealth and his wisdom by all sorts of dignitaries throughout the world, including the Queen of Sheba. But ultimately, upon his death, his son Rehoboam took the throne. But he was very unwise and very stubborn and arrogant, and he refused to listen to the counsel of the old men with wisdom. And ultimately, this united kingdom of Israel became divided, this occurring in 930 BC. And so it got divided into a northern and southern kingdom. Now, the majority of the territory remained in the northern kingdom, which was called Israel, just like the original kingdom was. And it ultimately, when it became divided, was ruled by Jeroboam, who was Rehoboam's enemy. And Rehoboam reigned over the southern portion, which was called Kingdom of Judah. Now, the southern kingdom, or the kingdom of Judah, was occupied by the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Now, even though there were two tribes involved, Judah is the name that the area became known by. And the capital, Jerusalem, where the temple was in Judah. Now, the northerners developed their own capital, but we'll talk about that in just a second. So anyway, the southern kingdom was known as the kingdom of Judah, and it included Judah and Benjamin as far as their inhabitants. And the other 10 tribes occupied the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, the capital of Judah continued, as I mentioned before, continued to be the capital as it was before, which was Jerusalem. And this is where Solomon's temple was located, of course. Now, the kingdom of Judah had some kings that followed God, and so did the people from time to time. But the northern kingdom, on the other hand, never followed God and only had wicked kings. And as I was mentioning to you before, they did set up a place of worship in a place called Bethel or Bethel, which they made their capital. And they gave a very half-hearted effort at acknowledging the true God, but mostly practiced the idolatry of the heathen people. And they mostly worshipped Baal. Some people pronounce it Baal, spelled with two A's. And so they tried to straddle the fence. But to be honest, they didn't even give a whole great effort at that. They basically were Baal worshippers contrary to God. And if you take a look at chapter 17 of 1 Kings, we see the great prophet Elijah coming on the scene in Israel, the northern kingdom. So now there's a great deal we could say about Elijah. In the interest of time, I'll just mention a few things. First of all, remember back in Luke when Jesus, when there were two figures that Peter wanted to make tents for, he wanted to make a tent for Jesus, and also Elijah and Moses, if you recall that. Well, that's just how significant those two people were in the lore of Hebrew history. And so Elijah was a very, very big part of the Hebrew history, and he was never forgotten and always considered great. But when he was called as a prophet to the ministry of prophet, he was called at a time when there was a very wicked king over Israel named Ahab. And Ahab's wife was an infamous woman that we've all heard of, and that would be Jezebel. So yes, Jezebel was the wife of the king of the kingdom of Israel. Sometimes I think people think that she was somehow some character from one of the heathen countries, but not true. She actually was a heathen, but she was married to the king of Israel. Of course, Solomon did not give them a good example, and unfortunately they followed in his footsteps. Now, Elijah was a great prophet, as I mentioned before, and he did some awesome things, and you can see the highlights of his ministry largely in 1 Kings chapter 17 and 18. And the irony of his life, though, is that despite his awesomeness and his miracles and his exploits for God, Elijah is found running for his life if you take a look in chapter 19. And guess what? He was running from Jezebel. Yep, Jezebel had decided he had to go. He had discredited all of their false prophets, etc., and actually they ended up being slain, a great number of them, under Elijah's leadership as a prophet of God. So he was found running for his life, huddling in a cave, scared to death. Isn't that something? And so later on in the chapter that I was just speaking of, we see Elijah turning his ministry over to Elisha, the prophet that took over for Elijah and carried on the banner. And as you'll take a look at that in the scriptures, it says that he passed on the so-called mantle, and he gave him a double portion of his mighty anointing. And so the remainder of the chapters go on to describe the reigns of some of the kings of Israel and Judah. And then we find ourselves at the end of 1 Kings. So we'll talk about 2 Kings as we get started on our next track. Okay, now being done with 1 Kings, we move on to 2 Kings. Now this book starts with the end of Elijah's ministry and life on earth. And we see in the second chapter that he is taken to heaven in a whirlwind, in a chariot of fire, after giving Elisha a double portion of his anointing. Now most of the following chapters discuss Elisha's ministry as a prophet. Now, just so that you can distinguish, Elijah is spelled with a J. Elisha is spelled with S-H. So then when we look at chapter 10, we see that all of Ahab's family is killed, including his wife Jezebel. Now, Ahab himself had already died in battle before this, even before Elijah left the earth. Now, this is followed by several chapters of information on the events during the reigns of several kings of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And then as you get towards the end of chapter 16 and into chapter 17, it corresponds to a time that's approximately 722 B.C., and we see a very momentous event where the Assyrians are besieging Israel and forcing them into exile. Now, the Bible makes it quite clear that the reason for this exile is the judgment of the people because they rejected God. Now, Judah had not rejected God as Israel had, but they would also have their downfall eventually, and we'll talk about that a little later. Now, in chapter 17, it talks about how the king of Assyria repopulated Israel with foreigners. Now, this is the origin of those Samaritans that we've talked about before in the book of Luke that were so hated. When these foreigners ultimately mixed with the Hebrews, they created a people who, in the Hebrews' minds, could never be pure, and just simply reminded them of their awful period of judgment. And just to make it worse, these people usually were loyal to Israel's enemies. Now, soon after this, Assyria threatened to conquer Judah also. But King Hezekiah asked God for help, and through the prophet Isaiah, he was made aware that God said everything was going to be okay. Now, the Assyrians did invade and tried to take over Judah, as it had Israel, but miraculously God caused them to leave Jerusalem wounded and in shame. Now later on, King Hezekiah became very ill, and God sent Isaiah to inform him that he was going to die and to get his house in order. But Hezekiah cried out in an appeal to God, and God mercifully added 15 years to his life. In Hezekiah's crying out, he had reminded God of the good that he had done on behalf of God, and that he was very repentant and sorry for any sins that he had committed. And he decided, reminded God that he had reinstituted the temple worship and other religious activities where Hezekiah's predecessors had stopped these activities before him. Well, God recognized this fact and was merciful and gave him 15 more years of life. Now, unfortunately, during this extension of the life of King Hezekiah, he made a very, very critical mistake strategically. He received ambassadors from Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq, and he showed them the greatest treasures of Judah. Now, through Isaiah, God told him the mistake that he had made, and that Judah's treasures would be laid spoil by the Babylonians one day. Now, the Assyrian Empire actually was conquered by the Babylonians. And sure enough, in 586 B.C. or so, because of their dabbling in compromise and their idol worship, God's judgment did come to pass on the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, prophets such as Micah, Jeremiah, and Isaiah had warned them of this coming judgment, especially Jeremiah. And the whole book of Lamentations is Jeremiah's chronicled weeping over his nation's exile to Babylon because of their disobedience. Now, one of the main reasons that this judgment occurred against Judah, besides their idol worship, etc., was that they had a habit of paying tribute money to foreign leaders for protection and to avoid them from attacking them as extortion money. This, unfortunately, was instead of calling on and depending on God for their protection. Now, one of the main people that they had depended upon in this way was Egypt. But when Babylon came a-calling, Egypt was nowhere to be found in their defense. Now, these kings also, when they paid these heavy ransoms, they taxed the people severely in order to get the funds. It's not they, the kings, that suffered. And so finally, when the Babylonians came under the leadership of and on the orders of King Nebuchadnezzar, some people would pronounce that Nebuchadnezzar, they looted the temple and carried away the most well-to-do Hebrews into exile. Now, this was the first of two such waves of removing people there into exile, into Babylon, of the people of Judah. Now, among this first group were people such as Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These, of course, were young Hebrew boys that became well known for their exploits in the book of Daniel, which we'll talk about later. Now, in the second wave, Jerusalem was completely destroyed and the temple was burned. And the remnant of people that were left there were taken into captivity. And with those events, the book of 2 Kings ends. And we move on to 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Now, 1st and 2nd Chronicles covers essentially the same time period and material that you find in 1st and 2nd Kings, but just with more detail in certain areas. There's discussion essentially of the events involving the kingdom of Israel before it was divided, during the division, and leading up to the exile. Now, in 1 Chronicles, it starts with a genealogy of the Abrahamic line all the way down to David and Solomon. And it also gives details on all of the tribes of Israel. Now, 2 Chronicles ends with a decree of Cyrus of the Medo-Persian Empire that God wanted him to rebuild his house in Israel. Now, as we've mentioned before, the Assyrians became dominant and took over Israel, the northern kingdom. And it was also, on the surface, dominant enough to take over Judah, but only because of God's intervention they did not. Well, no dominating force has ever stayed in power forever, and the Babylonian empire had taken over. Now, Assyria could essentially be equated to the Syrian people of today, and the Babylonians would be represented most closely by Iraq. But they had also been conquered by the Medo-Persians, and this essentially boils down to what is modern-day Iran with the Iranian people. And actually, even to this day, if you use the term Persian for a person, you are talking about Iran. And if you use the term Persia, you are talking about Iran. And so anyway, this is where we find King Cyrus making a decree that some of the people, some of the Hebrew people, could both go back to their land because God had spoken to Cyrus and told him to rebuild his house in Israel. Now, the next book in the Bible is the book of Ezra. And this is another historical book, just like 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, 1st and 2nd Samuel, Joshua, and Judges before it. Now, the book of Ezra describes the return of the Hebrew people to Jerusalem after captivity, and it occurred, this occurred in 537 BC. And it covers a time period of 538 to 450 BC. Now, the second group of Hebrews to return were led by Ezra, and he is the presumed writer of the book and its namesake at the very least. Now, one problem that was brought out in the book of Ezra is the intermarriage of the Hebrews and the heathen or non-Hebrew, so-called pagan worshiping people. Now, Ezra spoke out against this, but it was done anyway. This was Hebrew men largely taking non-Hebrew wives. Now, the Hebrew people would later confess their sin as a people and repent. And the book of Ezra is a short book containing only 10 chapters. But if and when you read it, you'll learn some very important information about the history of the people of Israel as they begin to return to their promised land. Now, next we have the book of Nehemiah. And the book of Nehemiah is another historical book describing the events of the third group of Hebrews that were repatriated back to Jerusalem. The rebuilding of the walls of the city is what Nehemiah is most known for, but it was both he and Ezra that restored the normalcy of Hebrew life as a people, as a nation, and also religiously. This book is also short, being about 13 chapters long. Next, we have the book of Esther, another relatively short historical book. And to describe, to begin to discuss the book of Esther, I want to go back and discuss the fact that we mentioned King Cyrus as the king that God spoke to, instructing him that he wanted his temple to be rebuilt back in Jerusalem. And King Cyrus was the first in a series of kings that oversaw this return and this rebuilding. King Cyrus was succeeded by King Darius, and King Darius was succeeded by King Xerxes. Now, King Xerxes was the king during the time of the Book of Esther. Now, later he was succeeded by King Artaxerxes. But during the Book of Esther, we have King Xerxes, and Esther begins to come to prominence when King Xerxes is looking for a new queen. Now, Esther was a Jewish woman, and she was not of any prominence in the Persian exile or captivity. She had no mother or father to raise her, and she was adopted essentially by a relative, an older cousin by the name of Mordecai. Now, when King Xerxes was looking for a queen, many eligible women, virgins with beauty, were presented, and ultimately he asked each of the women that he had chosen into a select group to ask for anything that they wanted. Well, Queen Esther didn't ask for anything in specific, and she said whatever is coming to her is all that she wanted. And for that and other reasons, Queen Esther gained tremendous favor. Excuse me, Esther gained tremendous favor, ultimately becoming the queen. And she utilized her position to better the lives of her people, the Jews. She did a great deal to forward their lot in life and to protect them and to defend them. And she was a great woman in the history of the Israeli people, particularly in her case during the Medo-Persian captivity. Now, her cousin, older cousin Mordecai, and her adopted father, essentially, is the one that had presented her to King Xerxes. And once she became part of his court, as before she ascended to queen, he would also always be worried about her, and he'd walk by and try to find out kind of how she was doing. And ultimately, Mordecai, when Esther was queen, Mordecai became the prime minister under her reign, along with her husband. And so the book of Esther is an amazing book. An amazing book about the rise of Jewish peoples during the exile in the Medo-Persian government. And so take a look at the book of Esther, because I think you'll find a great deal of useful information there. Now, this next section of books of the Bible are the poetic books. The idea of them being poetic, as you may recall, relates to the writing style, and it is peculiar to the Hebrew people. It is a form of writing where each line has a special relationship to another line, but it has nothing to do with rhyming. Now, as we discuss the book of Job, the first thing that we come to is the fact that it is, although it is a poetic book, it is not made of poetry. Its content is actually historical. Now, another thing about the book of Job is the fact that it is the oldest known book of the Bible. And it was written at approximately 2000 to 1800 B.C., about the times of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, the author is actually unknown, or not certain. Job himself, Moses, Solomon, and the young Elihu that you'll read about in the book of Job have all been speculated as potential authors or contributing authors to the book of Job. Now, the book of Job, for those of you who don't know or remember, is about a godly man who was blessed with much family and wealth. He lived in the land of Uz, or which is felt to be somewhere in the northeast Palestine, near desert land between Damascus and the Euphrates River. Now, the book shows an interaction between Satan and God, and it answers at least one reason to the question, which is, why do the righteous suffer? Now, it doesn't tell you all the reasons why, but it certainly answers the question as to one reason. It also is a reminder of who the battle of the universe is really between. Satan is not your enemy as much as he is really God's enemy. Now, the prize in this real battle is your love, your loyalty, and your eternal soul. And if God does not have those things, then Satan does. And Satan knows that this hurts God, and it is his mission to steal as much from God as he can. He knows that he can't win, but if he can make as many of us as possible losers along with him and break God's heart, that is exactly what he wants to do. Now, another important issue that this book addresses is, why do people serve God? In the very first chapter of the book, Satan asserts that Job only served God so well and sincerely because of the blessings that he had received. And he wagered that if God were to remove the hedge of protection from around Job's life and allow Satan to attack him, Job's fidelity would waver and he would curse God to his face. I'm only going to take a moment and comment on that little editorial. If you read that, then I want you to see, when you read it, what Satan is asserting. Now, it may not have been true for Job, but Satan knows man and his weaknesses, realize he's the one that was there that helped man take the fall in the first place. But Satan knows that the formula of man serving God because of what God gives him is a losing formula. God said, contrary to Satan, that Job was better than that. The problem is most are not better than that. Most are not that strong. Most are not that capable. Most are not able to say with a clear conscience, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. So this is a very good lesson here. Satan is pointing at a weakness, and he knows what he's talking about. Now, the majority of this book, about three quarters of it, shows the loss and then the gain of wealth, loved ones, and the personal health of Job himself. Now, throughout these very difficult times, Job remained steadfast in his serving and not cursing the Lord. And at one point, his turmoil got to be so severe that his wife advised him to just go ahead and curse God and die, assuming that that's what would result if he did indeed curse God, and that would result in ending his misery. Now, since God is silent in response to Job's desperate search for a reason for his calamities, Job had advice and counsel from many that he knew. They forwarded many theories, thoughts, and ideas, but none of them held up. None of them had the answer. Now, another question that Christians struggle with, is also answered here. Some will say that you only fail to get a quick answer from God to your appeals and to your requests because you lack faith and righteousness before God. Well, Job's case disproves this theory. And in the last 10 chapters of the book, the most forceful message and lesson comes forth. And that is the sovereignty of God in the whens and the wheres and the hows of life, and through whom he chooses to do his work and his will. In all these things, God is sovereign. And the last 10 chapters of the book of Job attest to this. Now, all too often, preachers propagate the idea that the book of Job is about Job's patience or his loyalty and his fidelity to God. But as you read chapters 32 through 42, you see differently. The point is that even though Job was righteous in his own eyes and probably in ours, and he also was presented to Satan because of his stature in God's eyes, he made the mistake that has always haunted man. Man's key flaw has always been pride. Remember something, that God initiated this discussion with Satan about Job, not the other way around. And the moral of this story is that even the best of us, at our best moments, at the best that we can be, our righteousness is but filthy rags. And it is man's curse since the fall in the Garden of Eden to forget that he was not, when he bit that fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, he was not elevated to God's status and stature. And that he is, from that very moment of eating that fruit, evil. Now, rather, we should realize that it is only love that causes the Creator to even put up with his creation after that creation chose to listen to and to follow the instructions of God's very enemy instead of listening to him. God expelled man from the garden, but that was a mild punishment. He created a separation between himself and God, which was the greatest injury that we could suffer. And it is only because of God's grace and His mercy and His reaching out to us over time that we have any hope at all. And as a beloved creation of God who can choose to love Him and to serve Him as Creator, that is our only redeeming value. Other than that, we are of very little value, if any. Now, God could have very well left us to our choice that we made in the garden, and He could have let us destroy ourselves and have eternal damnation. But even in the flood of Noah's day, it was, yes, indeed, a judgment for man's waywardness. But the miracle is that God cared enough to allow a remnant of man to remain. He could have destroyed us completely. Certainly Noah and his family were not perfect, but it was God's desire still, that glimmer in his eye, tugging at his heart, caused him to allow in his grace and in his mercy a remnant, so that we might multiply again and we might have another chance. And so indeed, God's grace outweighs God's judgment. We should get that picture correct. Now, the latter portion of Job sets the record straight. And if you read only one section of the Old Testament scripture, my advice would be that you read Job, especially the last 10 chapters. And I would say that along with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, the book of Job in general, but particularly the last 10 chapters, answers a lifetime of questions and mercifully guides man back along the way that he had lost from the Garden of Eden. Job's message is a universal one. It cannot be claimed by Hebrews, Gentiles, or any other select group. Job is a type or an example for all of mankind when he is at his earthly best and unfortunately is stricken with the weakness of pride. Every reader of the Bible should identify with Job, and every reader also has a lesson to learn. Because although Solomon was writing to essentially a Hebrew audience, there was no such claim that can be made about Job. We all can and must fully embrace this message, and in a real and in a very personal way. Well, that's it for the book of Job, and we're going to pick up with the book of Psalms on our next track. And is stricken with the weakness of pride. Every reader of the Bible should identify, and every reader has a lesson to learn from Job. Because although Solomon was writing to essentially a Hebrew audience in his writings, no such claims can be made about Job. We all can and must fully embrace its message, and in a real and very personal way incorporate what it's trying to teach into our lives. The next poetic book is the book of Psalms, and we're going to pick that up on your next track. Now, as we look at Psalms, it is much more obviously poetic. The Psalms are a series of works that express praise, worship, and confession to God. The authors include primarily David, Moses, and even Solomon. 51 of them, however, are anonymous. Now, although the Psalms parallel certain events, they were not meant to be a historical record. They were written between the time of Moses and the Babylonian captivity. And to get the most out of the Psalms, as with all of the Old Testament, you need to step back from the details and events and see the relationship between the Creator, Master, and Redeemer and His beloved creation. Now, the next two books of the Bible, again, of the poetic variety, are Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Now, Proverbs was mostly written by Solomon, and Ecclesiastes was entirely his. Proverbs was written early in Solomon's reign and contains wisdom regarding many aspects of life. It is this book that typifies the title that Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived. But Ecclesiastes, on the other hand, exemplifies wisdom that is from hard experiences of a man who took for granted his gift from God. This book is Solomon's earnest and maybe even desperate attempt to express the error and the emptiness of the life that he went on to live after his great beginning. He strayed far out of the will of God, and in his later years was sobered by his experiences. All of the wives, power, wealth, and fame were fool's gold, according to Solomon. Once he grabbed hold of these things, they failed to deliver their promise. Ecclesiastes is Solomon's attempt to share the harsh realities of the insignificance of all of his exploits compared to God's larger scheme of things. Also, he points out the unfulfilling nature of these temporal and carnal exploits. Proverbs exemplifies man's wisdom when he gets it from God and values it and is willing to live by it, as in the garden before the fall of Adam and Eve. Ecclesiastes, though, exemplifies man's condition when he decides with that wisdom that is given to him to go on his own prideful and lustful way, such as after the fall in the Garden of Eden. Solomon hoped for others to learn from his experience. Well, now, for the last of our poetic books, the Song of Solomon. There has been much controversy about this book, as I'm sure you can imagine if you have read it. It was not accepted easily into the Old Testament canon, and there is a long-standing debate on its meaning. Most scholars now believe that it is likely a literal rendering of the events involved in the relationship of Solomon to one of his wives early in his reign. Now, I have to admit, I myself have looked through it, and I at this point do not claim to know its purpose or its meaning, for that matter. And that's it, folks, for our second CD and our overview of the Old Testament. This CD included the historical books and the poetic books. And on your third CD, we're going to cover the prophetic books.